Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
A large collection of ink samples fills storage space at a small laboratory in Washington, D.C. The samples are kept inside a mix of soft plastic bottles and small glass containers. To the untrained eye, they are just a lot of dark liquids with strange names like moldy sponge or green grass. But to the United States Secret Service agents who use the ink samples, they could provide information that saves the life of the president. Agents say the samples also could help them stop criminals from reproducing money illegally. The ink library at the laboratory has more than 15,000 samples. They come from writing instruments and printing machines dating back more than 85 years. The collection is the result of one man, Antonio Cantu. He started collecting samples in the 1960s. Cantu was a well-known investigator and former chief chemist at the Secret Service. He died unexpectedly last year. The agency recently honored Cantu by naming the laboratory after him. The Secret Service uses the library to investigate letters threatening the president and other high-level U.S. officials. It also studies unlawful copies of official documents, letters written by kidnappers, and objects of historical interest. Scott Walters is a researcher who worked with Cantu. Walters says that for the past 15 years, people have been saying this kind of work was going to disappear as more people turned to computers for help. But he said that the laboratory continues to do important research. Handwriting, written documents, it's still such a large part of an investigation, he told the Associated Press. Cantu was an early leader in the field of static ink dating, in which scientists identify when ink was first made available to the public. Recently, for example, the laboratory received a letter that reportedly was written by Abraham Lincoln. Scientists performed tests to see if the ink dates back to the 1800s, when the former president lived. The laboratory is one of several under the Secret Service's Questioned Documents branch. The branch is also responsible for handwriting investigations and confirming whether a document is real or a copy. The office is involved in as many as 500 cases a year. It works on Secret Service investigations, as well as cases involving counterfeit money. It also helps law enforcement agencies around the nation and worldwide. In one investigation, a New York City crossing guard had created false offensive letters to police officers and a reporter. As it turns out, the crossing guard was trying to create false evidence against a healthcare provider, court documents showed. In another case, a former assistant to artist Jasper Johns created false documents saying that stolen pieces of Johns' work were his and he had the right to sell them. Other cases were larger. Walters studied documents from the September 11, 2001 attacks against the United States. In that case, hijacked airplanes struck New York's World Trade Center buildings and the headquarters of the U.S. Defense Department in Washington, D.C. "I could smell the fuel from the airplane," Walters remembers. Another researcher, Kathleen Storer, recently retired from the lab. She remembers studying one threatening letter. It led to legal action against a man who would only appear in court with a paper bag over his head. "That always sticks out in my mind," she said. "He really didn't want anyone to know he wrote the letter. We saw a lot of really unusual things." After Antonio Cantu died, Storer went through more than 16 boxes of books that he had collected. The books had names like The Story of Papermaking, What Wood Is That?, and Pulp and Paper Manufacturing. She created a small collection housed in the Questioned Documents division. Both the Ink Library and Book Collection were named for Cantu. She said what he added to the field was highly valuable. "People would come to the Secret Service just to work for him," she said. "He was a gentleman, pure and simple, and I believe his intellect was greater than Albert Einstein, truly," Storer said. Cantu's brother Vidal said the family had no idea how well-known and well-respected he was. "Seeing this, it only makes us prouder," he said at the ceremony renaming the laboratory. Laboratory director Kelly Lewis said the researchers are collecting new ink all the time. They also collect printer ink samples, take clues from each new case, and develop new methods to deal with modern criminals. I'm Pete Musto.
While no life has yet been discovered on Mars, humans have long considered the possibility of someday living on the red planet. The problem with this idea is that Mars experiences extreme conditions that would make it impossible for humans to survive. Two of the most extreme conditions are very low temperatures and high levels of radiation from the sun. Both of these make Mars currently unlivable for humans, plants, and other forms of life. Yet discussions continue about sending people to Mars, with some even proposing a human colonization of the planet in the future. The American space agency NASA has plans to someday put humans on Mars. NASA's goal is to first return humans to the moon by 2024. The agency then plans to carry out several moon missions in preparation for sending astronauts to Mars by the 2030s. A new study proposes a plan that may make it possible for humans not only to visit Mars, but also live there. The study involved researchers from America's Harvard University, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, and the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. The study, published in Nature Astronomy, explains how a material called aerogel might protect living things on Mars. NASA has described aerogel as the lightest solid material known. Most aerogel is made from silica, a substance found in glass. It is sometimes called frozen smoke because of its weight and cloud-like appearance. Aerogel, made with 99% air, is extremely light. The material also permits light to pass through while blocking harmful ultraviolet light radiation. Aerogel has also been used by NASA as an effective insulator to prevent its Mars vehicles from freezing. The researchers propose putting shields with a 2 to 3 centimeter layer of aerogel in different areas above the surface of Mars. Experiments involved a layer of aerogel and lights used to simulate Martian sunlight. Researchers reported the temperature on the simulated Mars surface was raised to 65 degrees Celsius. This temperature would be enough to melt ice on Mars. The study suggests that a layer of aerogel in areas above Mars would make it possible for enough light to reach the surface to permit photosynthesis. This is the process by which plants use energy from the sun to turn water and carbon dioxide into food. If successful, this process could give humans the ability to grow food on Mars. This would help reduce the need for supply shipments requiring costly equipment and fuel. The aerogel could also protect humans from harmful ultraviolet radiation. Laura Kerber is a research scientist at NASA's JPL. She helped lead the experiments. She said in a statement that after Earth, Mars is the most habitable planet in our solar system. She added, "But it remains a hostile world for many kinds of life." The aerogel could create small islands of habitability for humans and other living things, Kerber said. Robin Wordsworth is a professor of environmental science and engineering at Harvard University. He said the aerogel could provide a relatively easy solution to help make Mars livable. Spread across a large enough area, you wouldn't need any other technology or physics. You would just need a layer of this stuff on the surface, and underneath you would have permanent liquid water, Wordsworth said. The material could also be used to build habitation living spaces or self-contained biospheres on Mars. The researchers plan next to take their experiment outside the laboratory and into places that have Mars-like climates on Earth. Two possible areas include the Atacama Desert in Chile or Antarctica's McMurdo Dry Valleys. Like Mars, these two places experience very cold temperatures and extremely dry air. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week, our series brings us to the events of 2008. It was a year that combined one of the nation's worst financial crises with one of its most exciting elections in recent history. In 2006 and 2007, the American housing market began to collapse. Home values had been going up and up, Now, the balloon burst. People started losing homes they had bought with money borrowed on easy credit terms, loans they were then unable to repay. The hope was that the crisis in the housing market could be contained and that it would not spread to the wider economy. Traditionally, local banks would have suffered the losses on the bad loans. But times had changed. Big investment banks had been buying those loans. The investment banks then resold them as securities offering high returns. Credit rating agencies working for the investment banks had told investors that the securities were safe. Selling a financial product based on a large group of loans was supposed to limit the risk if a few loans went bad. That was the idea. But that was before millions of homeowners stopped paying their mortgage loans. Mortgage-backed securities became known as toxic assets. No one wanted to be anywhere near them. In March of 2008, Bear Stearns became the first investment bank to fail as a result of the crisis. Others followed. In September, Lehman Brothers, the nation's fourth largest investment bank, sought protection in bankruptcy court. Its failure only deepened the fears in credit markets. Toward the end of 2008, an international credit freeze developed. No one wanted to take the risk of lending money to banks or other companies that might have owned toxic assets. Some people feared that there could even be a global depression, the first since the 1930s. The United States economy, the world's largest, started shrinking at the end of 2007. The unemployment rate started rising. President George W. Bush's administration, Congress, and the central bank, the Federal Reserve, took extraordinary steps to deal with the growing financial crisis. Their efforts included loans to banks, automakers, and other companies. The aim was to rescue businesses that officials considered too big to fail. The bailouts from Washington were a decision that not all of the American people agreed with. But the people also had to make a decision of their own in 2008. It was a presidential election year, and the candidates were some of the most diverse in the nation's history. The Republican Party nominated Arizona Senator John McCain. At 72, he would have taken office as the nation's oldest first-term president.
So stand up with me, my friends. Stand up and fight for America, for her strength, her ideals, and her future. The contest begins tonight.
John McCain had been a Navy pilot during the Vietnam War. In 1967, the North Vietnamese shot down his plane and took him prisoner. He was tortured and held for more than 5 years. He returned home a hero. During the presidential campaign, he spoke often about his experience as a prisoner of war. His campaign message was, "Country first." Senator McCain quickly secured the Republican nomination to succeed George W. Bush. The Democrats needed more time to choose a nominee. The race settled on two leading candidates. One of them was Hillary Clinton. Her husband was former President Bill Clinton. They spent 8 years living in the White House. As First Lady, she held an unusually public role in her husband's administration. Later, she was twice elected as a senator from New York. Now she was trying to return to the White House, this time as the first woman president of the United States.
So if you want a winner who knows how to take them on, I'm your girl.
The other leading candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination would also make history if elected. He was a first-term United States senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. He was born in Hawaii to a white mother from Kansas and a black father from Kenya. If he won, he would be America's first black president. Blacks in the United States had been slaves until 1863. They were not permitted to vote until 1870. Women in the United States did not have a constitutional right to vote until 1920. And not until the 1960s did federal civil rights laws bar discrimination against either group. During the nominating fight between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, there was a lot of discussion and debate in America about gender and race. Some talked about the problems that women still faced in society and wondered whether Americans could accept a woman as president. Others talked about the problems that blacks still faced in society and wondered whether Americans could accept a black man as president.
I think we're ready. Well, I hope we're ready.
I just hear people comments, yeah, you know, that'll be the day when we have a black man running our country, yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
Candidate Obama gave a speech about race in America.
I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II, and a wild white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America, and I've lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents. And for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. It's a story that hasn't made me the most conventional of candidates, but it is a story that has seared into my genetic makeup the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many, we are truly one.
Many political experts predicted that Barack Obama would lose the nomination. For one thing, he was still new to many Americans, while almost everyone knew who Hillary Clinton was. Also, she had many wealthy supporters donating to her campaign. But political scientist Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia said those experts did not understand the country's mood.
They underestimated the power not just of Barack Obama, but also the yearning for change and the antipathy toward dynasty. The idea that the Bushes and the Clintons would essentially control the presidency from 1988 to potentially 2016.
Hope and change became the messages of the Obama campaign. Barack Obama won enough delegates to secure his party's nomination, which he accepted in August, shortly after his 47th birthday. His choice for vice president was Joe Biden, a longtime senator from Delaware. But Mr. Obama's nomination was not the biggest news story for long. The next day, John McCain had a big announcement of his own. His running mate would be Sarah Palin.
The Democrats had once nominated a woman for vice president, Geraldine Ferraro, but never the Republicans. Neither party had ever nominated a woman for president. Sarah Palin was the 44-year-old governor of Alaska. Few Americans had ever heard of her until she spoke at the Republican nominating convention. She referred to herself as a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
Some women said they admired her ability to balance work and family as the mother of five children.
I feel like she really speaks for me and represents me.
During the campaign, Barack Obama raised a record amount of money for a candidate, about $745 million. He became the first candidate to reject the modern system of public financing of presidential elections. Instead, he accepted smaller contributions from hundreds of thousands of supporters. His campaign made extensive use of the internet to collect donations, connect with voters, and organize volunteers. John McCain did not have as much money to spend. Something else also set him apart from the Democratic nominee. John McCain supported the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Barack Obama said he would bring the troops home from Iraq within 2 years of becoming president. But the top issue in the campaign was the economy. Again, Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia.
The fundamental issue in most presidential elections is the economy. It really is the economy, stupid, the old slogan from the 1992 Clinton campaign. When an administration has a positive, strong economy, they're tough to beat, even if it's a non-incumbent running. But when the economy turns sour, they're halfway out the door.
Barack Obama and John McCain agreed on at least one thing in dealing with the economy. They both supported President Bush's call for the government to bail out the financial industry. Many Americans disliked the idea of helping banks that had acted irresponsibly. But Congress agreed to let the government buy bad loans from banks and temporarily become part owner of some rescued companies. Supporters argued that the bailouts were needed to save the economy from collapse. In November of 2008, Americans elected Barack Hussein Obama as their 44th president. He received 53% of the popular vote. He won some states that had not chosen a Democrat in many years. A little more than 60% of voting age Americans cast their ballots, the highest percentage since 1964. Support for Barack Obama was especially strong among young people and African Americans. Many voters were emotional on election night.
I'm speechless. I'm trying not to cry right now. I'm thinking of my great-grandfather, my grandmother, and man, this is amazing.
Because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
But the election of 2008 was not the end of America's economic problems. What became known as the Great Recession would officially end in June of 2009, 6 months into the new president's term. But its lasting effects would continue to be felt all the way into the 2012 election season.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.